coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody and happy Tuesday night. I hope everybody is doing well. I'm so happy to be here live in the studio with you. I had a couple weeks there where I was on the road. I'll be back on the road coming up. Hawaii. I don't know if you can call that like road work technically when you're going to Hawaii for clients, you know, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be great. I'll get to be on the road with all my friends, all that kind of stuff. And of course, as always, we will have brand new content for you guys. Never in the history of either show have we ever done a greatest hits. Has it ever been repeat content? It has always been new content with us here at the show. So we're excited to bring that to you. And speaking of new content, there was a new announcement today from the White House, finally, about the drones. Let's play that out real quick.
And before I turn to questions, I do have news directly from the President of the United States that was just shared with me in the Oval Office from President Trump directly, an update on the New Jersey drones. After research and study, the drones that were flying over New Jersey in large numbers were authorized to be flown by the FAA for research and various other reasons. Many of these drones were also hobbyists, recreational and private individuals that enjoy flying drones. In meantime, in time, it got worse due to curiosity. This was not the enemy. A statement from the President of the United States to start this briefing with some news.
There you have that. We will be having Mike Turber on to talk about that update, all kinds of things as it pertains to the world of security, because once again, apparently not the enemy, all FAA, things like that. So our guest in this segment is the amazing Dr. Scott Taylor. He is the former president and executive director of the Moreau Institute. He is a NDE experiencer, a near-death experiencer, folks, as well as a shared NDE experiencer. That is what our topic is tonight, is shared NDE and how that comes to be. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Scott Taylor. How are you tonight?
Chris, I am awesome. And thank you for inviting me back onto the show. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And by the way, when you go to Hawaii, it's always just for fun. There's no like work involved, because it's, you know, sun and sea and lovely people.
Exactly. That's kind of how I look at it to begin with. We were talking pre-show about how I'm kind of a nerd. Like, all I do is wire racks of gear and dream about wiring racks of gear. So it's one of those, like, I wish I could say I quote worked for a living. You know, like, there is some physical labor involved, but aside from that, like, man, I love what I do on a daily basis, whether it's doing this show and researching topics like what we're talking about tonight, or whether it's out just wiring things and doing what I do on site. It's a blessing to be able to do it. So, and I always love our conversations, because it's about that sense of exploration and even the idea of near-death experience and embracing that, and embracing that as a field of study. I had the chance to go to the IANS conference a couple years ago. I sponsored it. And it was amazing to hear so many stories about this. How did you come to have a near-death experience, doctor? And what is the difference between a standard near-death experience and a shared near-death experience like what you had?
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful way to start. I want to go back for just a second when we talked about working and joy. You know, it's one of the things that near-death experiencers tell us, is that for our lives to run more smoothly and for our lives to be for that sense of fulfillment and a sense of we're on our mission is to follow our joy each and every day. And it's about, you know, waking up in the morning and saying, what would bring me joy today? And, you know, in your case and in my case, it's about the work.
Yeah.
It's about the things we do to earn a living. It's about the things we do for fun. It's about the relationships we nurture. And, you know, we just, there's nothing that brings me more joy than being able to share about shared death experiences and to be able to teach people how they're important to their individual lives and for us collectively as a human species. You know, it has great import. So that's a really long segue into how did I get into this? It's because I had a shared death experience, and it happened in 1981. I was in love with a woman. Her name was Mary Frances Randall. And Mary Frances and her son Nolan had been out sailing on beautiful Lake Washington in southern Minnesota. On their way home, they were involved in a horrific car accident. Mary Fran was killed outright, and Nolan sustained a mortal head injury that it would take him 6 days to make his final transition. That becomes important because Mary Fran was one of nine kids. And so when we gathered to hold vigil at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester as part of the Mayo system, wonderful care, we had all kinds of time to, you know, gather and be with Nolan as he's fighting for his life. There were so many of us that we just said, oh, we can't get into this little tiny hospital room. What would be the best thing to do is to just, two of us every 2 hours, we go in and talk to Nolan. Mm. The nurses had advised us that, even though Nolan was in a coma and he would never come out of that coma, even though he was in that coma, the last sense to go is the sense of hearing. So it was important that we talk to him.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, my shift, we drew lots, and my shift was 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. in the morning of the sixth day. And my partner was Jannie, Mary Fran's oldest sister. And we went in and, you know, we had his favorite storybook and we read him stories. And then we told him funny stories about his uncles who had about midnight gone through the Mayo Hospital and stolen the cushions off of the couches and put them on the floor of the waiting room so that we could, you know, have some place
to lay down and sleep.
To lay down and be comfortable. Yeah. I mean, because there was like 40 or 50 of us. I mean, there was a lot of folks, and we'd used up the chairs in a quick hurry. And so there we were. And so, you know, we just, it was light talk. It was fun talk. It was serious talk. And then it gets to be about 4:45 in the morning, and Jannie goes to the end of the bed and she looks at his vital signs and where he was and where he was now, and looked at the monitors that were surrounding his head. And she held out her hand to me and said, Scott, it's time for us to say goodbye. And so we pulled up chairs next to his head and we told him how proud we were of him and how impressed we were with his fight to stay alive and to be with us. But Jannie told him if his mother should come, remembering that she had died at the scene of the accident six days before. So if Mary Fran were to come for Nolan, to come for you is what she said, It would be the right thing to do to go with her, to be with her, and that we would always love and adore him and remember him. But being with his mother would be the right thing to do. And we, you know, just said to him that we would always love him and that he would always be part of our life. And then it's 5 o'clock and the next crew came in and our shift was over and we went back into the waiting room and found a spot on one of the cushions to lay down for a little bit. Well, Chris, it wasn't more than 45 minutes later that the nurse that was on duty came in and said, he's made a shift and his vital signs are now dropping and it would be time for us to go in and all be with him.
Yeah.
So this whole crew gets up and files into this little hospital room. And as luck would have it, I'm one of the last people to enter into the room and it's already 4 deep around the bed. And I went, oh, this is silly. So I just went over and sat on the windowsill next to Brother Willie. And we just waited. And what happened was that, you know, eventually he flatlines. And when he flatlined, what I experienced was Mary Fran coming across the veil and scooping her son out of his physical body. And they had this most exquisite reunion that, you know, you could only imagine between a mother and child. And it surprised me because I was able to feel what it is they were feeling. And then what surprised me even more was that they then turned and came over to me, embraced me, and then the three of us left and went to the light. And when we entered into the light, it was the most extraordinary experience that has ever happened to me. It was this unboundless love. It was unconditional. It was like every fiber of my being was merged with the love of the universe, that I was connected to that love and everything that was available. And yet, Chris, none of that mattered, because what really mattered to me was that the three of us were there and that we had a chance to affirm our love and affection for each other. We had a chance to say a proper goodbye. And, you know, because I wasn't anywhere near the scene of the accident. I was at work when it happened. And then we had a chance just to be together in that space for a while. And then at some point, it just felt complete. Mm. Like it was not like we're done or out of here, Taylor, you know, see you, bye. No, it was like, for now, we're complete. And that felt perfectly appropriate. So the two of them then turned and left and went further into the light. And then I came back into my physical body, sitting there at, you know, on the windowsill. So anyway, I should pause there and just say, any questions with that part?
A couple, because you were fully awake, you were alert. It's not like you had fallen asleep on the windowsill and this was a dream. It's much more like, what you experienced was a moment of bilocation with him as he journeyed forward.
That's exactly right. Okay, so we're going to jump right into part B of the story.
Yes, please.
Because you have a perfect segue there. So I was with Mary Fran and Nolan in the light, and I like to explain it like 100% of me was there with them in the light. And 100% of me was there in the room with the other grieving relatives.
Yes.
And I say it like that because it's not like my consciousness split. That would be to diminish either one of them. And that isn't what happened. What happened was I was fully present with them, Mary, Fran, and Nolan, and I was fully present there in the room. And I know this because as I'm sitting there, I am just glowing. It's like the love of the universe is inside my physical body and is trying to break out. And, you know, my countenance was of ecstasy and love and appreciation. And it was so overwhelming that if anybody had looked at my face then, they would have misunderstood that expression of joy. Because, you know, we just lost Nolan and we lost Mary Fran 6 days before. Nobody would have understood. Yeah. So I did the only thing I could think of, which was to take my hands and put them over my face so that I could hide my expression. And I stayed like that until, you know, my other consciousness that was in the lake could come back and the two sides merge again. And I was they both clicked into place and I could be with the other grieving relatives in the room, friends and relatives, and
on their plane at that point.
Yeah. And, you know, it was hugging and crying and it was incredibly sad. And I didn't know what happened to me. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary. I grew up as a mainline Presbyterian in a small town in southern Minnesota. There was no way that it could prepare me for being able to, you know, witness somebody coming across the veil and and that reunion with the two of them in the light and the communications that happened and, you know, me being in two places. I mean, that's just not part of the lexicon of the Presbyterian Church. I gotta tell you.
And, you know, I got goosebumps as you were telling your story and especially explaining the way it felt, because that is a lot of akin to what I consider to be my first religious experience, which is literally what led to my call to the seminary. And the only way I can explain it to people is I was bilocated. I was in the church with everybody there, but in the presence of something else at the same time.
Yes.
And that's the only way that I've ever been able to explain it to somebody, was that I was physically present in two places at the same time, not bifurcated in my mentality or anything like that, but uniquely aware of the fact that I was in two locations. And once again, like you said, with just a feeling of radiating love of everything.
Yeah, and I was plugged into and connected with and merged with that love. It is an experience that is outside of descriptions. In fact, it's one of the things that I think is important for people to know.
Please.
Is that, let's put it this way. I was so grateful that my experience did not happen in English. You know, because when you put words on things, it puts boundaries on concepts. And that isn't the way it was, you know, when Mary Fran says, "I love you," that expression included all of the times that we had been together and all of that exploration that we did, learning about each other. And it involved, you know, getting to know her son, Nolan, and all of the future that we wouldn't have together. And the acceptance of our families. I mean, it's such a big concept that it would take months to describe it, but it happens so quickly when it's nonverbal.
Yeah. Now,
and it's so I am extraordinarily grateful that I didn't have to experience it in words. And the flip side of that is that it's extraordinarily difficult then to describe it in words.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm doing the best I can for you, Chris.
You're doing a fantastic job and a beautiful job, Doctor. And one of the questions that I have immediately is, of course, had you, when this experience happened to you, were you already on your path of work with the Monroe Institute and brainwaves and things like that? Had that experience in life happened to you? Had you already been using binaural beats? Was this perhaps because you know as well as I do, once you're tied into that, the whole idea is for it to be easier for you to hit a zone specifically. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I just want to preface the fact that you had not begun your work in binaural beat therapy yet.
No,
so this wasn't like, you know, an adverse effect or something like that.
You know, I'm a 27-year-old, you know, junior buyer at a department store. I'm, you know, fully integrated into a work life and, you know, small town life. And there was none of the spiritual stuff had really come across. And when it happened to me, you know, the research around near-death experiences and shared-death experiences says that when you have this an event like this, it sparks intense curiosity.
Yeah.
And there's just, and in my case, it was, I was in the light with Mary, Fran, and Nolan. I was there. I was conscious. I was able to clearly communicate. Mm. And if I had done it once, I knew that I could do it again. I just had to figure out how.
Did you feel like it was the clearest communication of your life up to that point?
Clearest and most unclear. Meaning, you know,
unclear of purpose.
I'm getting all of this nonverbal communication and I don't know what all of it means. I can only be in the moment and be witness to it. And later I would have, through many, many meditative experiences using binaural beats, you know, begin to unpack that onion. That's a mixed metaphor. Let's try that again. Peel the onion.
Yeah.
There we go. But there's so much there to unpack that there are still things to this day. I mean, we're talking 40 years later here that I, you know, just go, oh my gosh, that's what that meant. That's what, you know, it happens to this day. And, you know,
and you
bless
know,
her heart.
One of the most important things, especially for any experiencer, honestly, whether it's experience of the paranormal, experience or of near death, experiencer of UFO, UAP contact.
Sure, sure.
It's one of those, like, where do you go to get help? Because it's not like IANS was around in the force that they are now. You know, it's not like the Bigelow Institute was just readily reachable, you know, for their consciousness studies project that they have going on now. These things are burgeoning as we speak, and there are communities that are still some of them being built on the fly as things come about. And it's fantastic because it is a chance for people, not just of like mind, but of like experience to come and share their experience without fear of judgment, you know, and that's hugely important.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you brought up IANS because it is this
I love them.
Incredible well of knowledge. I mean,
yeah.
IANS has been studying near-death experience for 50 years. Their website is enormous. They have a huge archive of stories.
Yep.
And, you know, they've got all the links to the research that's out there. Another yeah. one is NDERF, Near-Death Experience yep. Research Foundation, NDERF.org. They have another set of experiences that they have. Not only do they archive them, but they've categorized them. So you can search them like you can at IANS. IANS has the, you mentioned it before, has the advantage of being, or holding a conference every year.
Yeah.
And this year, in 2025 over Labor Day, it'll be in Chicago. So it's easily yep. accessible. It's very reasonably priced.
It is actually.
The speakers are fabulous. And it's the 50th anniversary of IANS.
Oh, yeah.
So they're going all out. And
well, and you know,
anybody in the listening audience, I put that on your calendar.
Oh, it's definitely a great one. And it's one that literally I don't consider myself psychic by any means, or I would say if anything, I'm maybe a little empathic in some ways. But that yeah. is one. And it's definitely something that, like, in my industry, you know, I'm used to dealing with very large crowds on the order of, you know, 5 to 10,000 regularly. But man, walking into the conference room at IANS was like getting kicked in the gut. With energy.
No, it's so true.
We
know
good
from
energy,
registrations
good
that
energy.
About half the people there have had an NDE, STE, shared death experience, yeah. or some kind of significant STE, which is a spiritually transformative experience.
Yeah.
So you walk into the room, like you said, and the energy is,
just totally different. Totally it's, different. It's beautiful. And,
you
it's
know,
amazing.
Everybody there, you know, is loving. And frankly, those who've had experiences, it's right on your name tag. It'll yeah. say something like, ask me.
Yep.
And you could spend the whole 5 days just
talking in hallways.
People.
Just talking yeah. in hallways. You know,
having
about
a cup of coffee. And
yeah.
So we love IANS. Thank you very much for making that reference.
But the whole point of that is the fact of, yes, while they existed, it's not like you could go to your local public library for, you know, a near-death experience or meeting, you know, where it's like, hey, let's go to a support group, you know, finding support
happened,
groups, things like that were much harder than they are now.
Well, back then there was only one book that had been written. And that was by Raymond Moody, and it had come out 5 years earlier. I love this word. It was a nascent study. You know, it was way, way, way at the beginning. And what we knew, frankly, Raymond Moody's book, even though it's not, you know, scientifically rigorous, that wasn't his point. His point was to gather stories and talk about them and to plant a flag out there and say, researchers, something really interesting is going on out here. Please take this and run with it. Meanwhile, I need to finish being a doctor. Because yeah. he was doing his MD at the time. He's an MD, PhD. I mean, totally bright guy. So it was really tough. And well, that curiosity that I spoke about, for me, the only thing I could figure out to do was to visit the ancient sites of the ancient religious sites around the world to see if there was any extra special juju
sure.
that was around that could propel me into that space.
And
so I did. It went all over the world. And I went to Machu Picchu and Stonehenge and the pyramids and the Sphinx and yada, yada. And for the most part, what I got was crickets. It's like, I just got great vacations all over the world. And, but, you know, and then I did seminary like you did. I also studied with shamans in North and South America. They helped me a little bit. But what really tipped the scale for me was the Monroe Institute, who had developed a meditation technique that uses binaural beats to help you enter into and hold those states of awareness. And it was there in their very first class that they teach. It's called Gateway. That class allowed me to contact Mary Fran.
Oh, wow.
And in the second class that I took, it's called Guidelines, about establishing a relationship with your guide or spiritual beings or whatever. And it was there that I really solidified my relationship with Mary Fran and Nolan and other relatives of mine who had passed on. And so I did. I found it. I found the way to go there again and be with them and be able to continue our conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I love that segue into how it spiritually led you to, because it is one of those, it's an ecstatic experience. I don't think you can, even if you have a near-death experience, it's not a journey near-death experience. I don't know anybody that hasn't had their heart stopped or their life come that close that does not change in some kind of way or isn't seeking some kind of answer after, you know.
And, you know, I'm sorry, but I have a little note here. I never answered your first question, which is, how are they different? How is a near-death experience different than a shared death? So many of you know that in a near-death experience, usually what happens, and that's heavy on the usual, that there is some sort of physical trauma to the body, and it's so bad that the physical body dies. And when it stops functioning, you know, our consciousness leaves our physical body, goes up into the non-physical world. It has an adventure. But meanwhile, back here in you know, physical world, the EMTs are doing their magic, bless their hearts, you know, and they got the paddles in the operating room, or they're on the side of the road of the car accident, you know, doing compressions, whatever they do. They reanimate the body. And then when that happens, of course, it just sucks back the soul. And, you know, and then the body reanimates.
Yeah.
And they're able to tell of their experience. So that's a near-death experience. A shared death experience is virtually identical, except the whole physical trauma thing. It's just that part's is missing. Because like in my story, I'm just sitting on the windowsill. I mean, I'm not hurt in any way. I'm, you know, I'm just grieving. Mm. That's all, you know, and I was waiting. You know, I had never held vigil with somebody who was dying before.
Passing.
Yeah. You know, you just kind of wait and try to be empathetic. And so, but all of the things that can happen in a near-death experience can happen in a shared death experience, and the after effects are identical. So, you know, even the casual observer would say these two are really similar.
Yeah.
And it's probably that same energetic pathway. We just get there in different ways.
And it's really interesting because as you describe that difference, it reminds me a lot of our conversation last week with Scott Guttrow, literally the difference between a ghost and a spirit. And the ghost is there and trapped in that way because of either trauma that they experienced on the way out or that they weren't able to process before they left, or possibly even your trauma of their death. because they're trying to be a spirit and stay behind to help you, you know?
It's one of those, you know, the hospice workers will tell you that in a large percentage of the time, people will wait, people, meaning the folks who are making their transition, they will wait until you leave and go to the restroom or go to have lunch.
Yeah.
So they're alone and they can, you know, make that exit gracefully. And it's not, you know, as a relative, you know, you got a lot of energy around keeping them here.
Yeah.
And when you go to have lunch, that energy isn't holding them back and they can freely leave. And so to your point, that's exactly right on.
Well, and it's really interesting to hear that, you know, especially, that you found the fact that HemiSync and HemiSync meditation binaural beat therapy, can recreate this experience.
So just a little primer.
Please.
For those of you who don't know about binaural beats, this is a very old technology discovered in the 1880s, and there it languished. Nobody knew what to do with it. And it was Bob Monroe in the 60s who determined that if you take, you know, one sound and you put it into one ear, say 100 hertz, and you put a slightly different sound in the other ear, say 104 hertz, the brain tries to equalize the two because that's how we determine where things are in space, in physical space. Well, it can't because they're inherently different and you're wearing headphones. So as a result, what the brain then does is it sets up a third tone, the difference between the two. And in my example, that would be 4 hertz. So, Chris, if you were wearing your headphones and I played 100 and 104 hertz and you were, you know, a willing participant, relaxed, I would put you to sleep in a heartbeat.
Yep.
Because that 4 hertz, the difference between the two, that is delta sleep. That is deep sleep.
Yeah.
Bob Monroe's genius was that he said, well, what happens if I combine them? And he said, what happens if I take wide awake alert? That's where we are now.
Yep.
You know, and that would be a difference, say, of 12. So you would have so you play that. So you have the difference of 12 and you play the deep sleep at the same time. And now all of a sudden, you have it where the body just kind of drops away from our consciousness because it is asleep or close to asleep, deeply relaxed. And then, you know, bright, awake, and clear would be that 12 hertz.
Yeah.
And so you're now in a state of this bright, awake consciousness, and the body is deeply relaxed. And that was the state that Bob Monroe used to jump out of his physical body and do the explorations in the out of body state, or some call it astral travel, same diff.
Yeah.
And so if you're able to do that, and he set up a whole institute to teach people about how to accomplish that. And along the way, he started messing with different frequency, you know, differentials and different combinations. And he discovered that, you know, based on what frequency you put into people's ear, their physical and their non-physical bodies begin to resonate at that difference, or that cake mix of differences. And they go to some very specific places. So, you know, my expertise is in near-death experiences, and we know that the tunnel, for instance, that transition vehicle between the physical and non-physical world, that exists at a certain frequency.
Yeah.
As does the reunion that you would have with the dead relatives, as does, say, a past life review.
Yep.
Or a life review, gets a better word. You know, there is a frequency where it makes it easy to connect with non-physical beings, angels, divine beings, dead relatives. You know, there is a frequency that's really good for that. And there's another frequency that is really good for that area where we exist between lives, that area of life between lives. And, you know, there's the Akashic records, and there is the universities and the places where we plan not only this physical world, but our physical lives. So there are many, many of these different frequencies. And you were exactly right into saying that as we change our frequencies, we have we can have a different set of experiences.
Yeah.
And the lovely thing about binaural beats is that it's easy. Well, I mean, you just put on the headphones, you relax into the tones. And if you are a willing participant, yeah, have the headphones on, within 20 minutes, you are there.
Yeah.
Full stop. No exceptions.
And, you know, I get asked, especially a lot whenever I'm on shows, talking about my therapy music, things like that, my chakra realignment albums, that kind of stuff. The difference between binaural beats and like frequency therapy, because frequency therapy is out there, you know, whenever you're talking chakra singing bowls, things like that.
Absolutely.
pure tone therapies. And that is an immersion therapy of a frequency. Absolutely. The difference is one of them, I akin frequency therapy to going to the spa, and binaural beats of going to the gym. Binaural beats is like sending your brain to the gym, because it's teaching your brain to literally create the frequency when it needs it.
Amen. And, you know, the lovely
just
thing
respond
is
to
about
it
binaural
when
beats is that, you know, you do an exercise 3, 4, or 5 times, you know, and the brain goes, yeah, yes, God, I got it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need the headphones anymore. All you have to do is remember.
Yeah.
And I'll take you right there.
Yeah.
And so you're not dependent on anything. It's a natural thing the body does anyway. We're just teaching it how to be there.
Yeah.
In a longer time period. You know, naturally we do, you know, have, you know, those aha moments that we have.
Yep.
Those typically happen around when the brain is synchronized, when the right and left hemispheres are working together on a, yep, problem, and they're at the same frequency. We get this aha.
Yeah.
And, you know, I solved the problem while I was singing in the shower. Great.
Yeah. While you were relaxed, while you were, I mean, that's, yep, one of the things that I kind of go to sleep with intention about is, how am I going to solve this problem?
Yeah.
You know, and
exactly,
and going,
right,
to sleep with that as an intended meditation to look for the answer to that problem, or look for the answer for the wiring diagram to something, you know, how to crosswire it, you know, those kind of things. And it's fascinating to see how our brains are so willing to go down that path. And the fact that it really is the whole concept that we speak about regularly on the show, the idea of the frequency of the paranormal. And the fact that it's right there. It's adjunct to reality. The only difference is the frequency at which it's vibrating. So,
amen,
once you've, yep, been there, you can get back there. You may even be like a watch with a magnet, where once you're exposed to the magnet, you'll never quite tell time the same way again, you know?
And you hit on an important topic, because when we enter into the non-physical universe, there are two things. One is that it's a lot easier if we communicate with symbols.
Yes.
Because they encompass so much information that it would take us, you know, a book's worth to,
yeah,
to communicate with English words. So it's a really valuable skill to learn this communication. And my second point has just drifted out of my brain. anyway.
Well, it's the idea that once again, your brain, even when it comes to research, when it comes to sharing research, one of the things that you have to wonder is, you know, if you're sharing research with a researcher in Japan, is the language that you're using bilateral? Does it translate to Japanese in a cognate fashion where no means no, or are there 18 variations of no, you know? Because if not, there's going to be some communication barrier there. And once again, if you get your brain used to speaking in symbol in that kind of way, there's a reason why music is an international language. It's because there's no letters there. We can all agree what a quarter note is. We can all agree what this is. So you can give a musician in China the same piece of music as a musician in the Amazon. And as long as they can both read music, they'll both play it the same way, maybe with a little different inflection because of how they play. But it's a universal language that you can learn to speak. And brain waves, getting your brain to that kind of space, is very much the same way, where our brains are made to recognize patterns. They're there. That's a part of our ingrained survival, is to recognize patterns.
And one of the things that's really helpful when you're doing binaural beats is to have a guide. And that's why I love the classes at Monroe. I love the classes that I teach through the Shift Network. And, you know, one of the things that we emphasize, to your point, Chris, is that we have we've identified at least 10 different ways that you can communicate in the non-physical realm. The first five are easy because they're just duplicates of our physical senses, you know, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, smell, taste, you know, that's the easy stuff. And then emotion, really helpful for communicating all kinds of things. Here's one I love, synesthesia.
Oh, yeah.
This is about where you take two physical senses or more and merge them. So you would say smell colors. And that has, you know, an entirely different set of meaning that you can associate with that. It's a little weird the first time it happens, but pretty soon you go, oh, by experience this smelling red.
Yeah.
It gives me a whole new perspective on whatever it is that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Intuition, of course.
Yeah. You know. I was just about to say that it's one reason why the world of binaural beats and things like that is highly used in the world of remote viewing. Because this is a lot of what translates over, is that idea of kind of cross-wiring your brain and teaching it to take what you would normally consider to be random monkey brain thoughts. You know, like people think that you have to be some kind of like meditative guru to do remote viewing. And it's like, no, it's actually 180 degrees as opposed to like trying to silence the world and get to a point of zen. You're trying to give the monkey a typewriter. You know, like type as fast as you can, monkey. Give me as much data as you can.
That's lovely.
You know, and it's
the monkey a typewriter.
It's odd. It's odd to have that, but once you get there, it's kind of freeing. You know, because it is a free association of things, and it may be the fact that you can't associate the color red, but you can taste it. You know, and it's interesting to see that amongst the remote viewing community, people who are better at seeing colors, people who are better at feeling colors, you know.
Exactly. And so the last two, I don't want to leave people wondering what the last two, synchronicity. In the physical world, all kinds of things will just show up and out of place. You know, a really common one is like cardinals will show up out of place, and they typically are harbingers of recently departed people. So, you know, it was like, really? Why are you here? You know, and, you know, they're pecking on your window and you haven't ever seen a cardinal. Anyway, that's an example of that one. And the last one is imagination, creativity. And, you know, if you go back into the beginning of Genesis, right, if you're a, you know, Hebrew Bible fan, you know, the opening of that, of the Bible talks, God talks about, you know, before there was anything, there was the void, and it was deep and it was dark. And God used his imagination and created light. You know, it didn't exist before. God had to use creativity, imagination to create something that hadn't existed before. Yeah. And we do that all the time. That's what imagination is. It's using that same creative force that God used when he created, you know, the physical world. So I highly respect imagination and its ability to act as a kind of like a prime the pump.
Yeah, a catalyst.
A catalyst to what comes after, because I just remembered what that second thing was.
What's that?
It was about how we use creativity to open ourselves up to have this direct flow from the divine. You know, in us, through us, so that we can then act in a way that's appropriate, because, you know, this universe that we're in, we're a physical universe, and physical universe requires action. And we talked at the beginning of the show that joy is something that will allow us to put action to our intuition. And to say, okay, today what I want to really do is just go for a walk out in the woods someplace. We get in the car, you drive there, you know, and you put it into action. And that's when things start to happen for you, because we live in a reactive universe.
Yes.
Meaning that what you put out is what you get back. It's not the other way around. People sometimes think the golden rule means that, you know. Mm-mm. What the golden rule is all about is what you put out there triggers your that imagination, that action triggers the non-physical world to bring you what it is that you need. And, you know, that's a huge thing to know, that intention drives everything.
Yeah, intention drives manifestation, quite literally. And you know, to take that beautiful poem that you brought up a second ago, the beginning of the book of Genesis, where the earth was formless and void, until God spoke and said, "Let there be light." It was his voice. It was the vibration. And that's where we, that's the one thing that I've always loved about Kabbalah, things like that, is that it really does reduce it down to the fact of God is the number one. No other number can exist without the number one. You exist because of the number one, and you're intrinsically tied to the number one because the number one exists. And it's like, number one, that'll shake your brain to begin with. But when you start getting into the fact of, because you are spoken into being, you now partake in that same divine vibration of creation, which is why your words mean so much. That's why when you curse somebody, when you say bad things to them, when you say mean things to them, it hurts more than a physical assault. It'll stick with somebody longer, you know? And it's interesting to see that, because, so frequently we speak our own path into being. And sometimes that can be a path of negativity. Sometimes that can be a path. And once again, just like training your brain to go into great frequencies to do beautiful things, you can retrain your brain through that kind same technology to start thinking better things, to start being more positive, you know?
So let's face it. I mean, we live in a crazy world right now.
A little
bit. Politics is just all, it's just crazy.
Fakata.
Anyway, and people who are anxious, about the future, about what's going to happen, yeah, yada, yada. Literally the best way is to remember what joy feels like and to go into that frequency of joy. I'm with you on this one, yeah, Chris, that it's all about the intent to be in a joyous place and to operate from that place. And if you operate from that place, then you are hooked into that primordial oneness, as you described it. It means that we are using that frequency that God used to create the universe. And it is overwhelmingly love. It's to touch that space, whether you do it through meditation or intention or a through shared a bi-location experience. There's all kinds of ways to touch it. But when you do, extraordinary things happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And once again, much like your experience in that hospital that day, much like your experiences with finding that again with binaural beat, that is a system that you have to consent into. You know, you literally have to allow your brain to do that and remind your brain that it's okay. Go do that.
You know,
you may be opening up a raw nerve for a minute or two, you know, most definitely, because I will admit all the time that shutting off that connection was something that literally led me to a point of addiction in life, doctor, wanting to no longer feel that connection when I walked into a room to know who to talk to, things like that. It can lead to bad places, but once again, you can find your way back from those things, you know?
And let's face it, the rule is, what do you do most of the time?
Yeah.
You know, we have a crummy thought now and again, and we act badly now and again. So what?
That's humanity.
Humanity. Welcome to the human race.
Well, welcome to a waveform.
It's like, I slipped again. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to operate from this place of love, and I'm going to, experience that with whomever I encounter today. And it's a hoot and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. And
when you choose that role.
Well, and it's much like stepping into any session, you know, you have to step into it with the best of intention. You have to step into every day with the best of intention. You know, it that is the frequency point that you have to hit, you know, is remember that you're part of that frequency, you know, like you're the beginning of the vibration of that string, everybody. And it's been a beautiful coalescence of conversation tonight, moving from your deep spiritual experience and how it led you down this path to how your work has led you right back to that journey and to a fulfillment of that and to being able to pass that beauty and connection on to other people, doctor. It's fantastic. We've got about 2-3 minutes left in that time. Let everybody know where they can get a hold of you, where they can go to take your, bilocation training and things like that, because you actually have classes that kind of send people down this path through it, both beginning and advanced classes. So let's talk about those classes a little bit, as well as your Into the Light series, which I absolutely love.
So the way to get a hold of me, or the way to you know, plug into this work, is to go to my website. You know, everything is there. So it's neardeathmeditations.com. Yeah, look at that. There's a picture of it there. Yeah. And there you can find out about my albums, which are an easy way to get into this work with binaural beats. And, you know, they're only $25 a piece. So,
great.
I mean, it's incredibly affordable. However, as I mentioned before, I am a big fan of having a guide and somebody that can tell you, okay, turn left, turn right, you know, do this, do that, and it'll help you get where you want to go faster without as much frustration. I have been teaching a series of classes for the Shift Network, And, you know, those links are on my website. And essentially what we're doing is we are using binaural beats to take people to the various places of a near-death experience so that they can learn to operate in the non-physical universe and to be able to be connected to that. And so I have, there's four classes that are on the Shift Network that you can take anytime. They're on demand. And we just found out Fantastic. Today that we'll be teaching another series of classes on bilocation, both intro and advanced, starting in September of 2025 for the intro class in January of 26 for the advanced class. And these are fabulous classes. You know, if I get to pat myself on the back, I'm going to do it because
you should.
These are really, really helpful for entering into states of expanded awareness, being able to hold them, being able to communicate while you're there, that whole symbolic language thing we were talking about. And then once you're there, it's like, okay, well, what do you do? So we have all kinds of things you can do. I mean, for me, I was driven to have communication again with Mary Fran and Nolan. I was able to do that. I was able to talk to my other dead relatives and friends and it just opened up the door to this amazing partnership that's available to us from the non-physical world into the physical world, because we can bring in those skills of the non-physical right into the world of the physical. And it just makes our life so much fun to live. It just gives us more peace and joy to have that perspective. So thank you for allowing me to hit that softball question.
Oh, no, absolutely. It is one of the, especially with people who are doing work like you out there trying to not only help people reconnect or even connect for the first time with that spiritual side, and understand the fact that that can happen outside of a building, that can happen outside of a doctrine. Those things can happen on a daily basis if you want them to. And that is absolute. I'm all about helping people spread that message. So, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this and being so open and candid, not only about your experience, but about the spiritual path that this experience sets you on.
Well, one of the things near-death experiences tell us is that we are on the cusp of some fabulous change for us as a human species. The transition may be a little rocky.
Yeah.
So that's okay. Let's learn what it is that this new world that's coming is going to be using those skill sets that we teach in the classes and that near-death experiencers have had a chance to learn. So, first one, pursue your joy.
That's
it. Do it with love.
Absolutely. Doctor, thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate it.
Chris, it's been a huge fun. We always have fun together. Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. You take care. You have a great evening. And I'll be sharing links for the show and everything tomorrow, all that kind of good stuff. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. While you are online checking out everything from Dr. Scott Taylor at neardeathmeditations.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the episodes. Don't forget, tomorrow night, if you are in the San Antonio area, we have the Symposium of the Strange coming up tomorrow night, featuring Josh Turner from the amazing show Paranormal Roundtable, my neighbor right down the road here in Austin. He will be talking about the Dogman phenomenon, not only here in Texas, but beyond. Interesting stuff. Stop on by, check that show out. It's been a great series. We'll be announcing more stuff soon, all kinds of things. So when we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, Earl Gray Anderson. He is the head of Southern California MUFON. We will be talking about all of the recent kerfuffle with the egg-shaped UFO. We'll be watching the egg-shaped UFO video that dropped. I got a chance to watch the whole three-hour conversation with the whistleblower. So we'll be talking a little bit about the whistleblower, his background, what some of his messages mean, things like that. When we come back from this quick break with our good friend, Earl Grey Anderson.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you so much for staying with us through that quick break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am for travel anxiety, daily anxiety, things like that, stop on by TrueHempScience.com. Use the code CURIOUS7. That will get you 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And get you two, count them, two edibles on the way out the door as well. Christopher Lynch uses a spigeric process to use and reuse and combust and reuse every part of the hemp plant, everything from seeds, stems, roots. Every part of the plant is used to create a full spectrum CBD product that is absolutely amazing, terpene profiles and everything. Stop on by and check them out. CURIOUS7 is the code that you want to use at TrueHempScience.com to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two edibles on the way out the door. In this segment, we are joined by our good friend, Earl Grey Anderson. He is the head of Southern California MUFON. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hey there, Chris. How are you doing, buddy?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Whenever I saw the egg-shaped UFO come out, I was curious about it to begin with. It was highly hyped.
That's your realm.
It was highly hyped all over the place, of course, as these whistleblower testimonies and things tend to be. One second, let me play the video real quick, the actual like 1 minute clip that comes from Ross Coulter and Reality Check on News Nation.
News Nation has independently obtained previously unseen video obtained from a secret UAP craft retrieval program. This extraordinary footage clearly shows an egg-shaped object dangling in a sling below the belly of a helicopter.
Now, that is the video that was shown, pretty much the video that's been out there. Now, what gets me, and this is just me, I only work in the world of audio, video, things like that. I don't know that I would drop a projector from the ceiling from a cable or a chain without a crew at the bottom to receive it. Much less an invaluable craft, be it our craft, be it an unknown craft, what have you. If this is something that you are sending a team out to retrieve, why is there no crew on the ground to receive it when it gets to the reception point? They literally just let the thing dead roll. Like, yeah. It just drops and rolls, which to me does not really, that, I don't know, that doesn't belie something intrinsically valuable to me. Whenever it's something along the lines of like, hey, let's go out in the middle of the night and retrieve this thing that was called in. And the story gets wilder, Earl. It's interesting. So, what is your assessment of the actual video that was put out of the craft itself?
Well, you know, most everything goes in my maybe box. Okay, like Peruvian mummies, you know,
maybe
that look sort of like, you know, you've seen the little memes where they have cakes made in the form of the Peru. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, Robert Salas, he went to Peru. He spoke with scientists there and they, you know, he felt like, you know, this just might be real. I don't know for sure. But this goes in my maybe box. Like a lot of things do. There's things about this case I like and things about this case that really raise my hackles a bit. But, okay, now, why was there not a team below the object to retrieve it? Maybe it's irradiating something. Maybe it's, you know, gamma radiation. You don't want to be near that. And we know a lot of these craft that people have died, if we are to believe some of the retrieval stories, like the Mexican Roswell case, mm-hmm. that my dear friend Ruben Uriarte kind of specialized in that case and did a, you know, on-site investigation. And apparently there were a lot of military members that were killed by radiation from that object. So that could be, you know, so you guys out there with the egg, I mean, if there's your excuse right there, you know, why there aren't any, you know, that's the only thing I can think of. Otherwise, you know, you would certainly have some, you know, and I mean, it looks like they're dropping it on some kind of pretty, you know, hard tack ground there. It doesn't look like this smooth. I mean, why were they taking it there? I mean, is there an underground base and there's like an elevator next to that area? Yeah. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah.
I wish that there was a little more provenance behind that video, that we knew a little bit more about its origins and what, you know. So, you know, I don't know. You know, and everybody, I mean, I'm sure like most people out there, the first thing that came to my mind was Mork and Mindy, Mork from Ork and his egg.
That is,
you know, Nanu Nanu.
In the 3 hour long interview, he said that is what they came to refer to this and other craft similar to it as was Nanus.
Nanus. Well, there you go. But I will say, there's a history of egg-shaped UFOs. I mean, the Lonnie Zamora case from New Mexico, egg-shaped UFO. It happened to have little landing legs, but, you know, that was one of J. Allen Hynek's favorite cases. So, and there you go. It's egg-shaped. And this phenomena sometimes just seems to have an intentional note of absurdity in it. It's almost like a signature. I mean, some of my favorite cases, you know, if you look at them, I mean, this is why some of the scientists roll their eyes and scoff. You know, there's like this silliness in it, like Monty Python is, you know, writing history. But some of that may be intentional, that, you know, it's kind of poking our idea of science in the eye, because we're still thinking in Newtonian terms. Most of the scientists I hear, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and, you know, they're kind of coming at things from a Newtonian perspective, and we know that the universe is based on quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like voodoo and magic. It's why Einstein hated it. You know, it's like God doesn't play dice with the universe. Well, apparently God loves a nice game of dice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's all about perhaps a game our of visitors dice. Have a bit of a ironic sense of humor. So why not a big Easter egg, you know? Send them on an Easter egg hunt.
Yeah. Now, and Easter egg hunt is where it begins. I mean, quite honestly, we're talking about somebody that is claiming a history in the world of intelligentsia once again. I find it fascinating that all of the whistleblowers coming out all come from the world of intelligentsia.
CIA, you know.
And, you know, yeah. Now granted, Jacob Barber said that he was recruited out of high school in a program, the GATE program, he called it, and was taken to combat control from there and put through a pipeline of side programs. His actual day job was right there at Dash 21, which is based in California. And Dash 21 quite literally is a rail shop. His job in the military on paper was actually an aircraft mechanic based in this shop that specifically dealt with transport of cargo.
So, well, there you go.
And that,
and I'll say that it is true that our, you know, the three letter alphabet organization I just mentioned, they do recruit from high school. They do recruit from YMCA and from churches and church groups and things like that. I have heard multiple times. And you know, I mean, yeah. I think my mom might have been one of them. You know, she was deputized as a young woman, and you know her history. You sort of have to have some, I think, intelligence background to be working in that field. My mom was. So more and more, I kind of just figure, I mean, I'll never know. I've only known one CIA operative, and I don't know why he told me he was one, except I was a nurse for his kid, at home nurse. I saved his kid's life once, and this guy had insomnia, and he would wake up, and we would have long talks. And this was back in the 1980s, and he admitted to me he was a CIA operative. So, and he even said, you know, it was YMCA. Yeah, that's where they got him from. So,
yeah,
you know, out of high school is not unusual. My mom was very young when she apparently was recruited into whatever it was that allowed her, you know, access to deep underground military bases. So I don't have any problem with that, you know.
Yeah, no.
It's a life or job. It is.
Well, it quite literally, especially whenever he's talking of it, he's literally my age. He's right at the same
young
age.
Pup then.
He's talking about, you know, graduating school in the mid-90s, you know, going into these programs and being recruited into them in like 93, 94, things like that. So
That does not surprise me. One little bit.
And even whenever I took the ASVAB, I remember I went and took it for a buddy of mine. I entered the seminary out of high school, went and took the ASVAB for a buddy of mine that entered the Marines, so that he'd get a little bonus. You know, like, hey, if you have a buddy, come take the ASVAB, you know, and you can prove that he came and took the ASVAB, we'll give you $50, you know? So it was a recruiting thing. I went and helped a buddy out, but like, they wanted me for intelligence.
Wow.
They were like, you seem to be really good at this part.
Are you sure you didn't take that job, Chris?
I don't know.
I never know.
But it is one of those, like, yes, like when you take the ASVAB, you will find out like immediately what, at least generally, they're looking at you for things like that. But to know that this guy was put through, as he called it, quote, club skills training, and went and took paratrooper training, went and took, you know, special weapons training, stuff like that.
And even
helicopter training, which is what led him into the work in the private sector, working in security and transport,
have no problem whatsoever with believing Jake Barber's story.
Yeah.
And, you know, something else that stood out to me and stood out to me strongly was, you know, people are laughing about it, and some of the nuts and bolts people are, you know, rolling their eyes about it. But the psionic element, as he put it, the psionic, you know, that there was a telepathic communication with him. This is not an uncommon thing. I've heard it from so many military witnesses who have had face-to-face encounters with our visitors.
Yeah.
And other really good witnesses on good cases. And I always hear the same kind of the way he described it. He said it was like this female energy, that he felt this great love coming from this female entity, and that there was a note of sadness in there. And that really got my attention, that note of sadness, because I've heard that so many times from so many. I've heard this from, you know, the exact same language from, and I'm not going to mention what aerospace company, but, you know, a big mucky muck from an aerospace company that is part of the military industrial complex, has 90 engineers working under him. And he had a visit by the little gray guys with black eyes in his room. And I have to take this guy very seriously. He has all the provenance behind him and the degrees and you know, I did ask to see a badge. You know, he was who he said he was.
Yeah.
And he mentioned the same thing, that it was this great love with a sadness, like, you know, like maybe we're either disappointing to this intelligence, like we haven't really that maybe, you know, we haven't passed some kind of test to enter the Federation or whatever is in charge of all this stuff out there.
Well, and there were some interesting things brought up in the interview with Jake. Once again, the idea of psionic communication, not just the idea of psionic communication, but the idea of psionic communication and control of craft. Earl.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
The idea that not only can somebody summon one of these craft, as we've discussed previously, a la CE5 and Greer, and it's interesting that that's brought up. It's interesting that he has a relationship with Greer and has talked with Greer. And take that.
Was that a bonus or a minus or a plus for you?
One of those. I consider all this stuff should be very well pickled. You know, it should all have a good tablespoon of salt and sugar with it, my friend.
The Greer Association, and all respect to Stephen Greer. He's done some amazing things in ufology.
There's also been some very divisive things within the community within the last couple few years. And there are things out there like CE5 that, you know, I am a big fan of the concept. I love the idea. I think the issue comes to bear at some point, though. Many of the people practicing these protocols are not adepts in the world of psionic communication, and is what they're summoning an actual craft, or is it something else that may not have good intent? And even last week, when we talked with Michael J.S. Carter about the idea of Project Bluebeam and the fact that, you know, many people in the community, interestingly enough, are talking angelic orbs and demonic plasmoids and things like that. And that was quite literally something brought up by Jake in the interview with the psionic communication, was the idea that many people with this psionic communication believe there to be this dichotomy of things being presented between good and evil. And he very black and whitely said, good and evil. Angelic or demonic, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I don't really pitch in with that stuff.
And Greer doesn't at all. Greer doesn't at all. He will claim that there will be zero negative communication through a CE5 protocol.
Hmm.
you know, that these well, things have no ill. And granted, hey, no doubt, my friend, if they had ill will, we would not be here. We would correct. All have a big backpack full of gold on us coming out of a mine working for the Anunnaki if that was the case. Yeah. You know, I mean, quite literally, if they were traveling from beyond star systems and had technology that we could not stop or detect, I mean, we can barely detect an asteroid before it hits us.
Yeah.
Much less something zooming in at the speed of light. So, yeah, if they wanted to destroy us, it would be a flick of the finger. It would not be any great amount of effort for us to be gone.
Look what a virus does to life on Earth, you know. So, I mean, you know, you can read The Stand by Stephen King and see how easily it would be to decimate humanity. I'm sure that if you're able to, you know, cross the great gulfs of outer space, light years, you know, you know how to do certain things like that, you know, extermination. And I that's why I don't really pitch in with the, they're here to eat us or to, you know, take over what, you know?
Yeah. Our defunct systems.
Yeah. I really don't pitch into the evil, you know, ultimate evil and ultimate good thing, though. The angels and demons thing really kind of gets on my nerves. I think that if you look at this phenomenon through human terms, that you're going to get human answers.
Yes.
And it's going to be, you know, it causes, you know, a lot of misconceptions in ufology. And I think that you have to realize nobody has to do anything. But the way I feel is that we have one intelligent race that we have to examine here, and that's the human race. Okay. As of yet, you know, people have had contact episodes, but, you know, at least I don't know any scientists, at least who will say, tell me, you know, that they have done psychological or anatomical investigations of our visitors. So my guess is that they're probably kind of like us. If you have free will, you're going to have good guys and you're going to have some bad guys. But most are sort of in the middle somewhere. You know, if an alien is having a bad day, maybe he won't telepathically communicate with you and make you feel, you know, warm and fuzzy while they're taking your DNA from you.
And we've had that discussion too, you know, even the idea of what we project onto them.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to that kind of interaction, you know, like that, the fact that we see it as invasive, do we see it as invasive whenever we go snatch up a male lion to make sure that they keep regenerating, you know?
You're using my favorite allegory right now.
Yeah.
I think I used it last night at our MUFON meeting.
But literally, you know.
We tranquilize them, you know, from a helicopter. We we'll put a tracking device
on
them.
For the good of the species.
We'll take their blood, you know.
For their own good. Their own good. You know, mm-hmm. so that they can continue because they're an important part of the environment, you know. Yes. So, who's to say that that isn't what's happening with abduction and things like that? And it is questionable. Once again, Dr. Greer has done what I consider to be pretty divisive things in the community. Mm-hmm. I think that there have been quite a few divisive moments injected within the community and within the conversation over the last simply year. Everything from Dr. Greer saying that the Betty and Barney Hill episode was a case of my labs, to the recent documentary, which has led to lawsuits from Peter Robbins and others regarding the New York UFO case. You know, these things are, I don't know if they're being injected in the community to necessarily upset things or to cause a dialogue that might be destructive, you know, because definitely that's how you keep witnesses from coming out. That's how you keep people from wanting to share their experience. And it's definitely how you keep scientists from wanting to be involved.
I agree. You know, a good old Robertson panel, 1953, ridicule them, trot out the, you know, your scientists ridicule them and, you know, say that anybody that, you know, says they've seen a flying saucer is crazy. And now it's, you know, that's being attributed to those who are our contactees, experiencers. That's their past mode of operation. So I imagine it seems to continuously be that. And I, you know, that's a difference I have between myself and Stephen Greer. I don't think that it's all roses and Viking looking aliens that are doing stuff. That's not what I experienced.
Yeah.
Mine just seemed very, you know, all business and, anyway. But you know, I think dogma is sort of like the end of all creative and open-mindedness and you know, original thought. And as soon as you decide something, it's this way, you know, and it isn't this way, you cut yourself off from learning. And that's one of the problems that I think in our scientific communities and in the three-letter organizations, they don't work with each other. And so, you know, the Air Force has one attitude about UFOs, and then the Navy seems to have a bit more, you know, open-mindedness about it. And it goes the same with, you know, people aren't sharing what they know with each other.
Yeah.
And we're like the blind monks in the room trying to describe an elephant, you know, the blindfolded monks, and one's got the foot, one's got the tail, one's got the, you know, the trunk, and one has the ear, and they all think that their specific part of this elephant is the elephant. And you actually need everybody, in everybody's opinion, to know what an elephant looks like.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it's the same thing with, you know, people, you know, deciding it's this way. And I'm not going to listen to other people, and I'm going to trash other people that, you know, think differently than me.
Well,
and we need them. We need other views. I welcome and embrace all, you know, it's why, you know, Jacques Vallée and Hynek, they wound up, you know, it could be us from the future. It could be interdimensional. It could be planetary, you know. They studied this for all those years, and that was and that's kind of where Jacques still stands today. I mean, we you don't have him being dogmatic about this being this.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that Greer has kind of maybe gone astray on. That,
well, scientifically, kind of especially,
position,
you know, it's hard to land on something that is still under exploration. You can have hypothesis, you know, healthy hypothesis is important.
My favorite hypotheses, you know.
Yeah.
I hope they're not here to eat us, you know, but it is a possibility still.
Sure.
You're talking with Ron James, and, you know, he mentioned that the other day, you know, on his podcast. It's like, yeah, I mean, maybe they will eat us. I don't think so. I hope not. But
I think we'd be a little stringy.
Have to do more of those CBDs, maybe.
That's right. But in all sincerity, you know, it is one of those. It's something that I talk about not just on the show, but whenever I speak at conferences. The idea of research, proper research, does not and cannot happen in a vacuum.
No.
It's fantastic to have an archive of things in banker's boxes in a closet. What? Good God, I hope somebody you know gets a hold of them after you die.
Yes.
Because otherwise, how is that data being shared? How is it being used in community? How is it increasing even the world of known quantitative? Like, hey, I'm all about red circles on a picture, you know? The more red circles we get, and now granted, you got to accept the explanation of what's in the red circle when presented. But the importance of that red circle and submitting the red circle for examination is that you are now expanding the realm of known quantitatives. And when you expand the realm of known quantitatives, you shrink the realm of the unknown. So
they're doing carpentry work out here. I hope that's
not coming out of my microphone. I can't hear that at all. You're all good. But in all sincerity, it's one of those, like, only through expanding the world of the known quantitative do we narrow down that gap of the 3 to 5%. You know, so we've got to be able to take in more data. We've got to be able to look at everybody's pictures and when they're submitted, things like that. It's what grows the data field.
This case, I've told you my pros and my cons with it, and I'm not going to go and make an edict that this is true, yeah. But I'm not going to go and make an edict on the other shoe either and say that it's a bunch of hogwash. And yeah. A lot of people have been saying that and trashing it on X. And it's like the same guys, haters of Lou Elizondo.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and all these guys, you know, David Grush. And it was kind of predictable that this would happen.
Yeah.
But there are things I really like about this case. There's other stuff that, you know, kind of raises my eyebrow. We'll see.
One of the things that raises my eyebrow is the actual damages done to Jake. The fact that he has suffered basically like microwave radiation burns. And one of the things brought up was actually microwave technology being used to down craft, microwave guns, things like that, to interrupt the way that they operate and to down them for retrieval, as well as even the idea of directed energy, microwave weapons being used on people.
Yeah. And we know that, you know, that all the above is, you know, that to my best knowledge, that's all true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, people suffer effects by getting too close to a UFO. I mean, I see it. I hear about it. You know,
I mean, Dr. Stankovic gave a fantastic presentation on the world of Havana syndrome meeting UFO UAP. And it's something that I've talked about. I mean, we talk about Havana syndrome and targeted individuals regularly on this show. So it's something that I am very, very well versed in, the idea of microwave weaponry and being able to target things with microwaves. It's fascinating technology, but it's also one of those, if it's being used for that, because that was one of the things brought up in the Immaculate Constellation hearing that happened, was that there were people, this being one of them, who were injured in retrieval programs.
Yeah.
That they couldn't acknowledge the retrieval program, but they were fully on VA benefits.
Yes.
From a retrieval program.
Well, isn't that interesting? And I will say, I mean, there's the UAP Medical Coalition that's out there, and I've attended some of their Zoom meetings and stuff. I wish I could contribute more of my energy and time to them, but I'm so busy what I'm doing here, you know. but they, you know, they've done some deep studies into this. So has MUFON, you know, Kathleen Martin spearheaded some studies into this. And to the best of our knowledge, there's you know, people that have suffered some health issues from getting too close to a UFO or by, you know, even visitation stuff. We see sort of like MS symptoms. You know, and you know, if we are dealing with gamma rays, with opening of portals, you know, supposedly that emits gamma rays. You know, the film Terror in the Sky, they had a bunch of scientists that they hired with monitoring equipment, and they monitored gamma rays coming from this thing that opened up in front of them. And then electromagnetic, the high electromagnetic charge that UFOs apparently use to evade gravity. All of that apparently has side effects, and maybe this is why you don't have as many close encounters as you would think you would.
Yeah.
You know, it's always a distant UFO picture, you know, the fuzzy distant UFO photo and video.
Absolutely.
But maybe they're protecting us, you know, and maybe the rarity where you have to take somebody. It's why, you know, you very, very seldom will I come across a case where somebody is abducted like, you know, three times a week or something. It seems like it's very gradual and not clumped together. And maybe that's to protect us, just, you know, a hypothesis. Again, I'm not trying to make edicts or anything on this stuff, but anyway, I agree though with what he said about the damage that can be done and that people have been harmed, you know?
And, absolutely. And it was interesting to hear him talk about the microwaves. It was interesting more to hear him talk about psionic and psychic use by the military, which of course, you know, we talk a lot about remote viewing. I attend the remote viewing conference and, you know, even though the government says that they don't use remote viewers, they don't, but contractors thereof definitely do.
Yes.
You know, and that's just it. Once things hit a proven realm, they'll gladly continue funding through other means. Mm-hmm. You know, because at that point you can use it in covert ways, and it's not like you have to task a military group with epaulets on their shoulders or something like that. Because as they talked about in the News Nation interview with Jake, once you put it in that chain, it's subject to a different set of rules.
Yeah.
You know, once you put it in the world of military chain of command, full control in that kind of way, instead of in the hand of private contractors, what have you. And that's a lot of what he talked about being on range. And let's hear a clip from him real quick about being on range and some of the things that were seen on range.
That's being used by the US government and its partners. I mean, I guess we all expect that there's technology that we don't know about that's being kept confidential for very good reasons, because the United States doesn't want foreign adversaries to know that it has an aerospace advantage or a weapons advantage over a potential rival.
Yeah.
And were you telling yourself that for a long time when you started seeing anomalous objects on the range?
Yeah, because just like it is now, you kind of have to train yourself. Even once you become a believer in the UAP subject, and you take some folks outside who are believers, and they look up, they get really excited and falsely identify a satellite as a UAP or something else in the sky, an airplane that has, you might not be able to see its position lights or its strobe.
So you know what Lou Elizondo has described as the five observables.
Yes.
Instantaneous speed, incredible hypersonic speeds, transmedium travel, water to air to water, positive lift, some kind of propulsion system that isn't explained by conventional systems. And stealth. So you were seeing objects that complied with those weird observables.
Yes. And at that time, you would also see things when you talk about the transmedium. So one of those that would raise your eyebrow is more of the transmedium characteristics, because things would come from the ground, like from the earth, from a ridge, from a mountain, or could pass through.
So they'd come out of a ridge.
Out of a ridge.
Which, of course, sounds a lot like a very popular show in the community, Skinwalker Ranch. You know.
Yes.
But when you're talking about, and this is something that I spoke about at the remote viewing conference, you know, like the whole idea behind remote viewing being founded, and the principles of it and the concept of it and the hypothesis behind it, coming from a laser scientist, Hal Puthoff, right here in my backyard, it's the same thing. There's a reason why people like him are read into these programs. It's because in order to, whether you're talking a gas laser, a solid laser, a liquid laser, a semiconductive laser, what have you, you have to know the vibrational principles of a medium so well as to change the way photons react and come out And instead of them coming out as a scattered light, they come out as a cohesive, powerful light. You know, so to understand that transmedium concept, to understand the way that a vibrational field can affect something, is massively important to not just the science of lasers, but the science of UFO UAP study.
Sure is. Sure is. You know, I agree with you 100%. And I think that maybe, I mean, there's such a giggle factor out there and an eye rolling thing that goes on with in ufology. And but you have to remember just the concept of a UFO, a nuts and bolts UFO, is crazy. It's just absurd. And but yet, you know, I've seen a UFO myself, you know.
Yeah.
So once you open the door to that, and maybe this is why disclosure is so difficult for, you know, officialdom to do, because once you open Pandora's box, you got all the, you know, it's the devil box, you know, yeah, opening up with every fate coming out. And I know that they're afraid of addressing some of these issues, and especially with certain religious communities and elsewhere, you know, that think of the terms of Satan and angels, and yeah, it's all this and all that, and there's no medium in the middle, no free will, really. It's all either angels or devils, you know. And I think maybe we have to be willing to open that demon box and see what comes out. And it's probably going to surprise people. And stuff like, yeah, this egg, as absurd as it sounds, you know, this entire phenomenon is absurd. In fact, I think sometimes it is that it means to be absurd. It's intentionally absurd. So, and there you go. And there it is.
Well,
and people are trying to say it was an aerostat now, and it doesn't, it's moving like it's weighted. It's not a balloon.
Yeah.
You know, the thing's weighted. So, but you know, everybody's all up in arms and freaking out about this thing. And I'm not, you know, it'll be interesting to see what it is.
Well, and you know, it's something that, Data, Earl. Data.
Yeah.
Data. And then wait for more data. You mm-hmm. know? And along the way, form opinions, reform opinions. Be willing to reform opinions, folks. But never forget the entire story. The entire story wasn't even released with the egg. All right. It was released like 8 days later. 8 days later, we got a full 3 hour long interview with Jake. And that's what I watched today that had all this other information in it, all kinds of things that really, really went in depth, and where you can see, once again, a lot of his actual natural reaction to the psionic things. And I will say this, even as an editor, there were some funky things about the interview. There were some funky things in the way that, you know, audio was there, audio wasn't there. It looked as though there had been second takes of a couple of the questions later on in the interview. There's definitely a spot where the question, where Jake repeats the exact same thing, and it's not like he repeated the exact same thing. They replayed the exact same thing.
I have to watch the 3 hour interview. I haven't seen it yet.
There were a couple little things like that. And I'm not saying that they coaxed the interview or anything like that. I'm just pointing as an editor, just some feedback, as quality control, just some feedback, you know, but he came off very, very genuine. He didn't come off as though he was hiding anything. He didn't come off as though he was making anything up on the spur of the moment or saying things that were rotely rehearsed. I also think he was very, very candid in the fact that, whenever he, he didn't dance around the fact that he couldn't answer a question. If he couldn't answer a question, he was very blunt with the fact of like, I'm not the person you want to ask that of because I don't have that answer. You know,
yeah. I mean, we have to ask the question, what's in it for him if he's lying? I mean, it could be, you know, I mean, there's such a thing as intentional disinformation.
Sure. From,
you know, we've seen that, you know, AFOSI and the whole, you know, Greg Bishop wrote a wonderful book, you know, is Project Beta or Operation Beta. Anyway, yeah. We know that is a possibility. So sure. But you know, you have to be open-minded enough to gather this stuff up and put it in your maybe box.
That's right.
And not laugh right off and not roll your eyes right off.
Yeah.
Because some, again, you know, this phenomena itself, it's absurd. You know, but, you know, people are starting to accept that it actually exists. And
that's right.
It's taken a while for that to take place, but so just keep an open mind about it, and we'll see what reels out. And
yeah.
I'm not going to say yay or nay, but I'm certainly not going to make fun of this guy or join in the Greek chorus of you know, doubting Thomases that are out there right now. They did this with a Tic Tac, and they were wrong. It turned out that the Nimitz affair and what happened on the Princeton and all that it was a real thing, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when that news story came out, and it was treated the same way with the exact same amount of eye rolling. And so, you know, I'm just going to, you know, people just remember, you know, there have been some absurd things about this phenomena that now we kind of accept.
Well, And the psionic connection,
that's
nothing new. It's nothing new. And it's fascinating. Let's hear a little bit about that real quick from Jake.
I knew something was about to happen. Does it happen to you?
Yeah, I would say that I have a keen ability to make good decisions short term and long term. I also find comfort in chaos, you could say. And I actually see things more clearly in chaos and tend to make very wise decisions.
And is that a quality that you recognize in a lot of your colleagues in special operations?
Yeah, you might be interested to know that people at an elite operator level, there's a lot of them that are left-handed, a lot of them that were artists as kids or still are, very good drawers, illustrators, musicians. They're also... If you were to describe their personalities, you might find yourself using some oxymorons like peaceful warriors, sensitive savages, you could say. That's a real thing. And I'll add one more. We're a bunch of dead serious goofballs. So there's this dichotomy between feminine and masculine at the extremes that I don't know if you could go as far as to say is the Big Blue Air Force and the Big Black Department of Defense knows what they're doing, and they're prospecting for these kids at a level, and they're planning this long-term, well-thought-out path. But what you will find is that we end up making our way there.
Something made you connect with...
That's fascinating, the idea that they are looking for that. And it's interesting to know that I remember when it came out that the military was actively watching gameplay and how people played games and looking for people that were apt in that kind of way and recruiting from that. You know,
it's how you find good drone pilots.
It's how you find, it's how you find great drone pilots. It's how you find people. Even whenever the assassination attempt happened and, you know, everybody was like, oh my, how did a 21-year-old execute this? I'm like, I don't think you've ever played one of the games that these 21-year-olds play, where literally the job is to climb up and snipe somebody. Like, that's your job for the day. Welcome to your job in the 5-man crew. You know, when that's literally used to train things, it's interesting. And when you hear Jake later talk about NHI, that has been a huge, huge buzzword in the community for a while now. Since David Grush first put it out there, the idea of non-human intelligence and what that might mean. And Grush was very, I think, evasive in terms of what that meant. But Jake was very forthcoming with that. And the idea that not only is the craft intelligent, but the beings inside are not. And he referred to them as like robotic meat.
Wow.
Like,
well, meat, that kind of explains why they don't mind crashing them.
Meat robots. Yeah. Yeah.
But I've heard avatars used or like replicants, like from Blade Runner.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why, you know, perhaps why you don't mind crashing.
That's just it.
Is you that know, the, into Roswell and losing your pilots.
Yeah.
You know, that they're maybe temporary.
The drone part of it is the pilot. And and that's what's interesting. And that's why the psionics work. That's because it's the craft itself, which is intelligent.
Wow.
And that was the flip flop that he popped in there in his interview, was the fact that the craft is intelligent. The thing piling it is not. And that's why the psionic people and the people using telepathy, as it would be called in normal, or I guess everyday nomenclature, I firmly understand the reason for psionic control instead of telepathic control, because until telepathic control denotes intelligence, you know, it denotes that you have taken over an intelligence, and that's not the case.
Yeah.
Even though you're psionically and could psionically control the craft and it responds to you, it doesn't mean that you have telepathically taken over control or what the intent of that craft is.
Boy, that's so interesting.
And it's fascinating. And this is one of the reasons why I am a fan of UAP, Earl, because the definition changes everything. It changes everything. It changes the way you look at the phenomena. Not the object, because it may not be an object.
Yes.
That you're looking at. You see?
Yes, I do.
And
I get that. I still like to use UFO just because I
love it.
UFO
I
love nostalgia it. Or something, you know?
I'm with it. I get it.
The term. But UAP is probably a better term because it's a phenomenon. It's unidentified anomalous phenomena. It's not even an aerial phenomena
that's
anymore.
Just it.
They've change that up and probably in a good way.
Yeah.
You know, if they come out of the ground, and I believe they do, you know, I've heard that one before too.
And that's,
you know,
just
from very intelligent witnesses.
One of the things that I remember Hal Puthoff talking about at the remote viewing conference that I saw him at Menlo Park, was a case where somebody passed through a UFO.
Yeah.
And I've heard it referred to in MUFON cases, things like that.
Well, and they take people through walls and windows and, they don't seem to care to go to the trouble of opening the window first or the door. Think about it, matter is mostly, emptiness. It's vacuum.
That's right.
That's what the universe tricks itself into existence. We maybe trick it into existence, the shared illusion of reality.
Yeah.
And again, this is quantum physics and the way that science really is. And it sounds like voodoo or black magic and, or satanic maybe. It's going to scare people, but that's the nature of the universe.
But it's matter. That's just it, though, is that it is an absolute truth. It is something that we know is there. And it's, we talk about it regularly on the show, the idea that we know that there are more than three dimensions. We know that there are. We know that they are just adjoining to us. So the idea of something vibrationally being out of sync or not being able to be seen by the very narrow bandwidth that our eyes see, like 4 nanometers of bandwidth within the electromagnetic spectrum, folks, is visible light. that our eyes can see. So it's like 4 terahertz or something like that is what our actual bandwidth is. Parrots can see a little bit more. Octopi can see a little bit more, you know, yeah. but to know that these things may exist just outside of that vibrational range, you know, adjunct to us, not away from us, not even from other star systems, just adjunct and here. Mm-hmm. And the craft themselves could be intelligent.
Yeah. Well, I have heard this from very, very good sources before this guy came out and said that. It's not, again, this is nothing new. And I have personally worked on many cases where, and they're usually military, not exclusively, but a lot of military guys where they'll have an experience, right, taken or visited. And then they start having these dreams that are realer than dreams where they are piloting a craft themselves with their mind. They're being trained to use their mind. And, I had one of my favorite cases was one of a Marine that was taken through the ceiling of his barracks at Camp Pendleton many years ago, back in 1968. And he still believes he has contact today. It initiated some kind of a connection with this other intelligence. And I spoke with his children, with his wife. Everybody said, yeah, Dad went to Vietnam, but that's not – he doesn't talk about Vietnam or PTSD from Vietnam. He talks about his experience with the aliens.
Yeah.
And he told me, he said, well, you know, they scared the hell out of me. I thought it was the devil at first when it happened. But then, you know, but now they're teaching me how to fly craft. And I have these – dreams that are realer than dreams. He was, you know, it was like a bubble, a transparent turquoise bubble. And he shared this very detailed account of flying this thing with his mind over the San Diego Navy Yard.
Wow.
And but he's not the first person to tell me this. You know, I've had other people in the military. You know, I had one woman put in a case where she was, you know, using her mind to fly this. It sounded exactly the same as what he described. And I didn't really make that part of the case public ever. I mean, this may be the first time I ever mentioned that element to the Camp Pendleton case. I had another woman who she described the same thing with a turquoise bubble shaped like this turquoise sphere of glass that she was in, and that she was being taught to fly this thing with her mind. And it was funny because after I spoke with her, she gave me the date, and it was over a military base. And then somebody from that military base, completely unconnected with her, she was not military, they put in a report of a blue, like a glass sphere that was flying over the base same day. So you tell me, you know, it's a very strange phenomenon. Nothing surprises me. There is no lid to the strangeness of this thing.
Well,
people are limiting themselves when they roll their eyes and they say this can't be real, because that's what they said about meteors falling from the sky at one time. And that it was proven that rocks do indeed fall from the heavens.
One of my favorite books that I actively got at MUFON at the bookstore is this actual scientific desk reference of strange phenomena. And there's another one of, like, you know, strange zoological things, all kinds of stuff. But the fact that this is an actual site, the last time it was printed was 75, the year I was born. So it's not like it's from like ancient history. This was a scientific desk reference from 1975 that has articles going back to the 1600s, things like that about, you know, crop circles, about you know, strange meteor showers, about lights in the sky, phantom lights, orbs, you know, ball lightning, all kinds of stuff, man. So
Clark's laws, you know, respected scientist said something is impossible, he's probably wrong. you know, and any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But yet, you know, we encounter natural things that seem like magic to us, and it causes us to roll our eyes.
Yeah.
Well, it's like paranormal. You know, people have a problem with the term paranormal. And I just say, well, you need to expand your idea and understanding of what normal is.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to use the para in front of it. Just have more of an open mind about normalcy, because the universe is weird.
That's right.
You know?
That
shouldn't exist. I mean, we shouldn't even exist. This should be nothing, you know.
Yeah.
But here we are. And that's strange. And it's self, you know.
Yeah, precisely.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know?
Well, and that's a really good question for this one. That's punny.
Oh man, these guys have a buzzsaw out here.
But it is the fact of, you know, we do have to be more open-minded. We do have to be more inclusive with our definitions of things. One of the most important things out there, I think, is finding universal definitions that work, Earl, and you know, ways that science can talk with each other beyond boundaries, beyond cultural boundaries, things like that. Because without that, once again, you're working in a vacuum. You're working in a cultural vacuum at that point. And the way that you're
it's
looking
at the S&M thing and the fear of someone else, you know, developing some weapon first.
Yeah.
And that shuts off all chances of advancement. I mean, you know,
Well, I am excited to see what comes of Jake Barber. I was excited to see what came of Grush and the second round of testimony from things with him and the rest of the panel was fantastic, I thought, and more revelatory than a lot of people thought.
Yes.
And I think that the things coming from he stepped before inspector generals, things like that. He stepped into skiffs with people and talked about this stuff. So it'll be fascinating to see what comes of the next one, Earl, and what comes of the next hearing about
it
these things.
Be.
So thank you
Keep
so much for coming
open
on.
Open mind and
That's
stay
right.
curious.
That's right.
That's
exactly.
The trick.
Exactly.
Okay, guys.
Before we let you go, bud, let everybody know where they can go to catch up with you, where they can go to file their reports there in Southern California and beyond.
Well, to find out what we're doing at Southern California MUFON, you can go to SoCalMUFON.com, just SoCalMUFON.com. That's our page there, and you can click around. We have, you know, like different, you know, state director's desk. I got to put my new blog up there. It's I've been slacking on that. We currently have a meeting. We try to do them every 2 months here in Southern California. We had a very rainy day yesterday, and it was after all the fires and everything. And boy, we had a full house. We had a full house yesterday.
That's good
so
to hear.
It was wonderful. Dustin Eskelson, Utah's state director and ERT member, spoke, and he was fabulous. My wife loved the presentation, and she feels like she lives with an alien. For her to say, "I really enjoyed that UFO presentation,"
that's good stuff.
Is saying a lot.
That's
she's
stuff.
You know, gets her fill of it just living with me. But come and join us if you're in Southern California, and you can see some of our past speakers. We do on the last page on there. On the events, I think, on that page.
Yep.
We have some videos like Paul Hynek and Steve Bassett and other folks. We will be posting some of Dustin's presentation yesterday. It's fabulous. If you see a UFO or you've had contact with an anomalous entity that you believe is related to UFOs, go to MUFON.com. And on that very front page, it will say report a UFO or report an abduction or a being. And that's what you do. And it does. Thank you, MUFON, for having the Starlink satellite explanation up there.
Right up top.
Every time SpaceX shoots up another Falcon 9 rocket, I get like maybe five reports. And because it looks weird. Just remember, normal stuff looks weird, you guys. Normal stuff is weird.
Yeah.
All right.
That's right.
Jake Barber included.
That's right.
I like to meet him. You know, I like him just watching him talk, you know, and be open-minded, folks. And let's see what happens, right?
Exactly.
Don't throw the baby out with the bath water. You know, if you don't like Stephen Greer, you don't like this element or that, you don't have to accept the whole thing.
That's right.
But just be open-minded. And that's the only way we make progress in this field.
Precisely. Yeah. Earl, thank you so much for your time as always, my friend. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with everybody. While you are online checking out everything from Earl Gray and Southern California MUFON over at SoCalMUFON.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can find not only all of our episodes and the also content from all of our guests, but also our special playlist there from YouTube of UFO and declassified government panels. It's fantastic. That's where you can find the entire 3-hour. We have that entire 3-hour Jake Barber interview pinned on there. So go on by, check out that playlist. Make sure to like, follow, subscribe to Curious Realm on YouTube, everybody. Also, make sure to stop on by Curious Research if you are a field researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP. We have a great store there with tons of equipment, tons of field stuff, DNA collection equipment, all kinds of things, including our field observation and encounter log. So stop on by, get your copy of that. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.